The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the February 17th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Travel ban challenged in court. What happened? The immediate fate of President Donald Trump's executive order on immigration and refugees lay in the hands of federal appeals court this week, with the case likely headed for the U.S. Supreme Court. Enforcement of the ban on immigration and travel from seven Muslim-majority countries was temporarily suspended last week by U.S. District Court Judge James Robart in Seattle, in response to a legal challenge by the Attorneys General of Washington and Minnesota. That decision, which opened a window for immigrants from the blacklisted countries to enter the U.S., was immediately challenged by the Justice Department. And on Tuesday, a three-judge panel from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments from both sides. The panel's ruling on whether the travel ban should be suspended until its overall legality is decided will almost certainly be appealed to the Supreme Court. President Trump tore into Judge Robart on Twitter, criticizing the so-called judge for his ridiculous ruling, saying it leaves the country vulnerable to terrorist attacks. If something happens, the president wrote, blame him and the court system. The president also called the appeals court so political and accused the dishonest press of deliberately failing to report on terrorist attacks. They have their reasons, he said. White House officials later released a list of 78 acts of terrorism all over the world that they claimed hadn't received sufficient coverage, including the widely covered attacks in Paris, Orlando, and San Bernardino, California. What the editorial said. Trump is right on the law, though it was foolish of him to pick this fight, said the Wall Street Journal. The Constitution and the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1952 give the president authority to suspend the entry of any class of aliens that would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. Still, Trump aides Stephen Bannon and Stephen Miller created this mess by rushing out a sloppily written order, and Trump's rants against the judiciary are offensive to the rule of law. The authoritarian president has now added an entire branch of the federal government to his enemies list, said the New York Times. Trump's insinuation that Judge Robart and any judge who doesn't bend to his will be to blame for future terrorist attacks was chilling. He clearly is seeking to undermine the judiciary, the most dependable check on his power. And it also sounds as though Trump plans to blame meddling courts for any future attack. What the columnist said. The executive order is unconstitutional, said Paige Pate in CNN.com. It's clearly a de facto Muslim ban. Candidate Trump called for a ban on Muslims, and his advisor Rudy Giuliani recently boasted on TV that the president had tasked him with crafting a legal way to construct such a Muslim ban. That intent violates both the Fifth Amendment guarantee of equal protection and the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, which prohibits the government from giving preference to one religion over another. Not so, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Foreigners seeking admission to the U.S. have no constitutional rights. Moreover, the president has always been given extremely wide-ranging powers on national security issues. The courts are trespassing on a core executive responsibility. Trump's attacks on judges should frighten us all, said Paul Waldman in TheWeek.com. Not only is he preemptively deflecting blame for future terrorist attacks, he may also be setting himself up to exploit them. If and when an attack on U.S. soil occurs, Trump will whip up fear and anger, announce that he tried to keep America safe but was stymied by meddling judges, order surveillance of mosques and deportations of Muslims, and perhaps even worse. If judges tried to stop him, there's a genuine question of whether he'd obey lawful court orders. The judiciary isn't Trump's only target, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. He is now insisting that polls showing that the majority of Americans disapprove of him and his policies are fake news, and he continues to deride the media as dishonest and untrustworthy on almost daily basis. Trump's motives aren't hard to discern. Like all authoritarian populists, he insists the people support him and seek to delegitimize any person or institution that could place serious, meaningful limits on his power. And a second main story today, Trump takes aim at Dodd-Frank. What happened? President Trump moved last week to unravel Wall Street restrictions and other financial regulations passed by Democrats in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, signing an executive order that calls for a review of the sweeping Dodd-Frank Act. The 2010 law calls for a reined in a risky mortgage practice and derivatives trading and created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Trump's order can't overturn the law, which was passed by Congress and can only be repealed by lawmakers, but it instructs the Treasury to meet with regulators to discuss possible changes. Trump said his planned overhaul would make it easier for Wall Street to approve loans to companies, allowing businesses to hire more workers. I have so many people, friends of mine that had nice businesses. They can't borrow money, said the president. Trump signed a memorandum ordering the Labor Department to review the fiduciary rule, which takes effect in April. That regulation requires brokers to act in a client's best interest when giving retirement advice, rather than push investments that yield higher profits for financial advisors. An early draft of the memo deferred the rule's start date by 180 days. That delay didn't appear in the final version. Senator Bernie Sanders and Trump said Trump had betrayed his campaign promise to stand up to Wall Street. I don't mean to be disrespectful, said Sanders, but this guy's a fraud. What the columnist said. So who's ready for another financial crisis, asked Richard Esko in HuffingtonPost.com. Despite all his tough talk on Wall Street elites and protecting the little guy, Trump has declared war on some of the most fundamental financial protections guarding ordinary Americans. Without those safeguards in place, we can expect a repeat of the big bank excesses that cost so many people their homes, savings, and retirement security in the last economic meltdown. The president announced this regulatory rollback while flanked by Wall Street CEOs, letting the American people know whose side he's on, and it's not theirs. Dodd-Frank has made things worse for Americans, not better, said Bob Ehrlich and J.C. Boggs in Forbes.com. The Mammoth Act produced approximately 24,000 pages of convoluted and costly new regulations. Small businesses complain that these labyrinthine requirements make it difficult to secure good loans and to build their companies. No wonder we're experiencing one of the lowest growth periods in our nation's history. Trump's order can only do so much, said Ian Katz in TheHill.com. If Republicans really want to unravel Dodd-Frank, they'll have to squeeze things through using budget reconciliation or somehow persuade Democrats to help them pass repeal legislation. Actually, Trump could easily let Dodd-Frank die a slow death through neglect, said David Dayen in TheNation.com. The president has just sent a huge signal to regulators to stop enforcing rules and avert their eyes as the banks return to making risky bets and committing all the other sins that led to the financial crisis. Trump's order is just a message, but it's a scary one. Next up, our controversy of the week. Democrats, should they become the party of no? After 3 months of wandering in a post-election wilderness, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times, the Democratic Party seems finally to have settled on a strategy for surviving the age of Trump. Resist. Last week, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi rallied her caucus to stand our ground against President Trump's agenda, while Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's 48 Democrats are boycotting hearings on Trump's cabinet picks, using parliamentary tactics to delay confirmation votes, and threatening a filibuster of Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. To stop Trump's aggressive attempt to remake Washington and the country in his own image, Democrats have decided to embrace a new brand, the Party of No. That's what the party's base wants, said Ed Kilgore in nymag.com. Right after the election, millions of people showed up for Women's March and dozens of other protests around the country, providing proof of the intensity and breadth of public opposition to Trump. The new president's provocative policies on immigration and the environment, as well as his far-right cabinet nominees, also convinced congressional Democrats that their only viable strategy was total resistance to the 45th president. Good luck with that, said John Fund in NationalReview.com. A relentlessly negative, hyperpartisan tone will only turn off the moderate working class voters Democrats need to woo to have any chance of winning back the House and the Senate. Perpetual outrage is fatiguing, and braying donkeys are not appealing. Trump's biggest asset may be the obstructionism and hysteria of his over-the-top adversaries. Obstructionism sure worked for the Republicans during the previous 8 years, said Alec McGillis in the New York Times. Senator Mitch McConnell and his colleagues refused to cooperate with President Obama in any way, even on proposals to create jobs for working-class Americans. McConnell, it turns out, was right. Voters don't really pay much attention to Washington politics and judge the president and his party on a simple standard. Is he getting things done? Republicans were rewarded for their obstruction by gaining control of Congress. It would be flat-out nuts for Democrats to compromise with Trump, said Alan Pike in thinkprogress.org. Any cooperation with the GOP would fatally blur the brand distinction between a Democratic vision for the future and Trump's bug-eyed retreat into fear and vengeance. Trump's approval ratings are already going south. Becoming the party of no is both morally right and strategically smart. Besides, said Gabriel Debonetti in Politico.com, the party's base will not tolerate any sign of accommodation. Trump is so extreme, so unhinged, and so authoritarian that progressives will turn their fury on any Democrat who isn't 100% against him. If Democrats are smart, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com, they'll go beyond their base and work to bring a wide and deep coalition aboard the anti-Trump train. Businessmen, free market conservatives, deficit hawks, and libertarians are all dismayed by Trump's immigration ban, his proposed Mexican wall, his bullying of companies and judges, his threats of tariffs and trade wars. Most Americans do not want to be dragged back to the 1950s. Rather than just saying no, Democrats must counter Trumpism with an affirmative message that our tolerant, dynamic nation is richer and better because of immigration, international markets, strong alliances, and freedom. We can't cower behind walls or let fear destroy what makes America great. And time for our good week, bad week shorts. It was a good week for finding true hate. After a new dating app promised to match potential mates based on things they both despise instead of shared interest. Dubbed Hater, the new service is based on research showing people are more inclined to bond over shared negative opinions than over likes. It was a good week for crunchy tributes. After a single Cheeto thought to resemble the slain Cincinnati Zoo gorilla Harambee sold on eBay for $99,900, the item attracted 132 escalating bids. An 8.3-ounce bag of the snack food retails for $2.50. It was a good week for sick burns after pop diva Mariah Carey made a music video showing her throwing the dress that she was supposed to wear at her canceled wedding to billionaire ex-fiancé James Parker into a bonfire. The custom Valentino gown was valued at $250,000. But it was a bad week for overserving after the Mount Airy Casino in Pennsylvania was hit with a $25,000 fine for serving 27 rum and cokes to a gambler who finally fell off his stool. Let me say from the outset that this is unacceptable, the casino's attorney conceded. It was a bad week for a full-time job after Australian researchers found that working more than 39 hours a week damages a person's physical and mental health, especially when combined with parenting responsibilities. And it was a bad week for Sean Spicer, who may soon lose his job as White House press secretary, according to CNN. President Trump has reportedly ordered aides to find a replacement because he thinks the embattled Spicer looks weak and was appalled that Saturday Night Live had a woman, Melissa McCarthy, impersonate him. The title for our briefing page article this week is The Sanctuary City Showdown. The nation's biggest cities are preparing to lock horns with the Trump administration over undocumented immigrants. What is a sanctuary city? The term loosely applies to about 400 cities, counties, and states across the U.S. that limit local law enforcement cooperation with federal immigration officials. These jurisdictions range from sprawling metropolises like Los Angeles and Boston to smaller counties in rural Oregon and Kansas. These communities have varying policies. Most do not permit police to inquire about a person's immigration status, and some do not turn over undocumented immigrants to federal officials, even if they're arrested. President Trump argues that sanctuary cities have become safe havens for criminals, and in January signed an executive order vowing to strip such jurisdictions of federal funding if they refuse to cooperate with federal immigration officials. That move has set up a legal showdown between the Trump administration and every major city in the U.S., says Rahm Emanuel, mayor of Chicago, one of at least three dozen sanctuary cities that have openly vowed to defy Trump. This is not the battle they want to take on. When did sanctuary cities appear? The vast majority of sanctuary cities adopted their policies in protest of a Bush-era deportation program known as Secure Communities. That program automatically sent the fingerprints of people booked into local jails to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, or ICE, allowing ICE to target and deport immigrants who had committed only minor crimes, such as traffic offenses. Some cities argued that their police were being turned into proxy immigration agents, damaging community trust, and refused to cooperate. That resistance continued during the Obama administration, which sought to deport those charged with serious crimes. When Trump ran for president, he vowed to crank down on sanctuary cities, making the tragic case of Kate Steinle a centerpiece of his campaign. What happened to Steinle? The 32-year-old was shot dead by a stray bullet in July 2015 while walking along San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf. Steinle's suspected killer, Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez, was an illegal immigrant who had been convicted of 7 felonies, most of them drug-related, and deported back to Mexico 5 times. He had re-entered the country and was being held by the San Francisco Sheriff's Department over a decades-old marijuana charge. ICE asked the sheriff's office to notify them when Lopez Sanchez was released, but San Francisco, a sanctuary city, let Lopez Sanchez walk free without providing that notice. 3 months later, he fired the bullet that killed Steinle. Trump called the shooting a senseless and totally preventable act of violence and campaigned with a group of women he called angel moms, whose relatives had been killed by undocumented immigrants. What does Trump's order do? The executive measure threatens to withhold all federal funds except as mandated by law from jurisdictions that fail to comply with federal immigration law. Republican lawmakers and other sanctuary city opponents argue that local jurisdictions don't get to pick and choose which federal laws they enforce, and that by rejecting more than 17,000 detention requests from ICE between January 2014 and September 2015, sanctuary cities were sheltering criminals. Trump's approach would finally put federal executive action on the side of the victims and potential victims of crime, says Roy H. Beck, head of an anti-immigration advocacy group called Numbers USA. How have sanctuary cities responded? They contend that Trump's order is unnecessary and counterproductive and have vowed to fight it. Most sanctuary cities already approve ICE detention requests if the immigrant has a history of serious or violent crime. Police groups also argue that sanctuary policies actually make a city safer by allowing the country's 11 million undocumented immigrants to report crimes and work with police without fear of deportation. "We're the melting pot of the world," said Captain Jeff Scroggin, spokesman for the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. "The most important thing we strive to do is build enough trust so that residents provide information that makes this community safer." In 2015, sanctuary cities experienced 654 fewer crimes per 100,000 residents than non-sanctuary cities, a crime rate that's 15% lower. What happens now? Trump's executive order seeks to bring sanctuary cities to heel by stripping them of federal funding, which can make up 25% of a city's total budget. A major legal battle will now ensue. Cities will rely on 2 Supreme Court decisions, the 1997 Prince versus United States ruling, in which the late Justice Antonin Scalia wrote that the federal government is prohibited from commandeering state and local officials to enforce laws, and a 2012 ruling that struck down an enforcement mechanism in Obamacare's Medicaid expansion. It's very easy to campaign that the king is going to wave his scepter and somehow take away federal funding, said David Narkowitz, mayor of Northampton, Massachusetts, a sanctuary city. But this isn't the campaign anymore. This is a president who functions in a larger government, a government of laws. Moving into the best columns of the week, the first comes from the U.S. Why Franken might run for president. Is Senator Al Franken emerging as the Democrats' strongest contender for the 2020 presidential nomination? Asked Josh Krashauer. During hearings on President Trump's cabinet nominees, the former comedian impressed colleagues and liberal activists with his sharp, informed, and aggressive grilling of Jeff Sessions, Tom Price, and Betsy DeVos. Franken will also be one of nine Democrats on the Judiciary Committee questioning Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. Those high-profile hearings could serve as a springboard for Franken to become the party's most visible and popular elected official. Since he arrived in the Senate in 2008, the Minnesota Democrat has largely kept a low profile, working diligently behind the scenes. In 2014, he won re-election despite a Republican tide, partly by wooing rural, working-class voters with his Bernie Sanders-like advocacy for protectionist trade policies. And though Franken is still identified in many Americans' mind with his stint on Saturday Night Live, he was educated at Harvard and has proven policy chops. Yet he still wields a sarcastic wit that can provoke gusts of laughter even at dull Senate hearings. If Democrats want their own famous face to challenge Trump, Franken fits that bill as well as anyone. This column from the UK. Why we'll lose to U.S. on trade. The British people will be the losers in the coming trade deal with the U.S., said Ed Conway, and it's not because President Trump is such a great negotiator. There has always been a strain of mercantilism running through the American bloodstream. The Americans wrongly assume that if another country sells them more goods than it buys from them, they are losing, and the foreigners are winning. Our American cousins are obsessed with their slice of the pie, ignoring the fact that free trade would make the whole pie bigger for everyone. Prime Minister Theresa May now says she wants to strike an equitable trade deal with the U.S. when the U.K. leaves the European Union. But the world's only superpower will surely have the upper hand in these negotiations and ask for more than it will give. So would we allow U.S. healthcare firms to run parts of the National Health Service? Are GM crops welcome on our supermarket shelves? Can U.S. educational firms set up schools here? Do we harmonize our regulations with those of the U.S. and dump the EU written regulations we've used for years? And if we do that, what would it mean for our exports to Europe, which are still worth far more than those that crossed the pond? You see how tricky this will get. And this column from Israel, how Kushner let down the Jews. Shame on you, Jared Kushner, said Allison Kaplan Sommer. The Orthodox Jewish husband of Ivanka Trump put his reputation on the line last year when he defended his father-in-law against accusations of anti-Semitism. Then presidential candidate Donald Trump has retweeted a meme that featured a photo of Hillary Clinton next to a Star of David and a pile of cash. Writing in the New York Observer, which he owned, Kushner described his grandmother Ray Kushner's harrowing ordeal in Nazi-occupied Poland and how she lost much of her family in the Holocaust. This background, he wrote, gave him the ability to recognize true intolerance, of which his father-in-law was not guilty. Since Kushner used his Holocaust legacy to promote Trump, it's fair to force him to confront the way in which he is now party to inflicting his grandmother's suffering on others. The administration in which Kushner serves as a senior advisor has slammed shut the doors of the U.S. in the faces of vulnerable refugees. One detail missing from Kushner's article, Ray and her family were denied entry to the U.S. in the mid-1930s. Had they been allowed in, his relatives might not have been slaughtered. Gone is any sense of pride Jews felt at seeing a U.S. president's family celebrate Shabbat. We now feel shame, and so should Jared. And it's time to move into our in-depth article, The Last Word. Interesting title this week, Opening My Mind to Psychedelics. I was skeptical about the supposedly beneficial powers of trendy hallucinogenic drugs such as ayahuasca, an ancient Amazonian brew, said writer Grayson Schaefer. Then the visions began. Are you feeling the plants? Pluma Blanco whispered. It was nearly midnight in the dark, darkened great room of a mansion overlooking San Francisco. I was kneeling behind a makeshift altar arrayed with objects of spiritual significance set out by the 20 or so other house guests lying prone on blankets on the floor. Beneath the entire slumber party stretched a large canvas drop cloth that was soiled with mahogany stains from the previous night's bodily expulsions. No, I told the shaman, feeling a little ashamed. When the Uber driver dropped my girlfriend Emma and me off, it was a beautiful summer Saturday. The cars parked along the shady lane suggested a barbecue or dinner party. But inside the open door, we found an assemblage of alternative healers, PTSD sufferers, recovering opioid addicts, and wanderers padding quietly around the dimly lit spaces. There may be a purging. Have you heard about the purging? One of the shaman's assistants asked. He showed us a stack of plastic painter's buckets and what looked like an ordinary trash can. But hours later, after prayers, meditation, snorting a sinus-clearing liquid tobacco called tzonk, and finally ingesting a strong cup of ayahuasca, the psychedelic brew at the center of the ceremony, I felt nothing. Around us, the others were in the throes of vomiting or deep in psychotropic stupor. The shaman wore a purple cast on his right arm. He'd broken it a couple of weeks earlier while mountain biking. He was stocky and well-muscled in his late 40s with a close-cropped faux hawk. He'd been born to Midwestern Christian missionaries in the Darien jungles of Panama, where he'd lived for his first 15 years. After college, he returned to Panama to study plant medicine among the same indigenous Imbera healers who had given him his moniker at birth. But friends here still know Pluma Blanco by his one-syllabled American name, which I've agreed not to use. That's because dimethyltryptamine, DMT, the active ingredient in ayahuasca, is still illegal. Schedule 1 drug. Ayahuasca is actually made from two plants, the Banisteriopsis capi vine and the Cyclotria viridis shrub, both found across the jungles of Central and South America. The P. viridis leaf contains DMT, though if you ate it, your stomach acids would zap it before anything happened. The trick is in combining both the leaf and the vine. The odds of anybody randomly combining these two otherwise inert plants out of all the millions in the jungle into a stiff brew are nearly impossible, something that would require divine inspiration, which is how indigenous folklore describes ayahuasca's discovery and ceremonial use throughout the Amazon basin since at least 1000 BC. Pluma came over and poured another ounce or two of the earthy liquid from a stainless steel hydro flask bottle on the altar. I put the cup to my lips and for a second time tasted the sweet, woody flavor. It went down like a comet and sat like a burning sphere in my chest. Still nothing. He poured another cup, then another. He lit tobacco, inhaled, and then exhaled onto my forehead. He sang lilting songs in Imbera. Behind my closed eyelids, I gradually became aware of an animated ball of light that was drifting off in the distance. I followed it, bringing it closer until it entered my body and then exploded in the form of projectile vomit. Good, Pluma said soothingly. If you've been paying attention to pop culture, you may have noticed that America is in the midst of a psychedelic renaissance. Burning Man, the epicenter of loosely tolerated drug use, isn't even edgy anymore. The buzz among Silicon Valley types is that microdosing on LSD boosts creativity. And instead of making pilgrimages to Peru, where backpackers have long sought out ayahuasca with indigenous shamans, tech bros are reaching enlightenment without even leaving their zip code. Until the mid-1960s, mushrooms, LSD, and DMT were all legal. Then in 1970, Richard Nixon signed the Controlled Substances Act, CSA, and psychedelics became politically toxic as a research topic. Now, however, they are once again finding acceptance in academia. Privately funded research sanctioned by the FDA and the DEA has been underway at New York University and the University of Wisconsin, among others. Scientists at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine have used moderately high doses of psilocybin to arrest major depression and existential anxiety among terminal cancer patients. At the University of California at San Francisco, a preliminary survey is currently looking at whether ayahuasca has therapeutic benefits for people who are struggling with PTSD. At 38, I'd spent the better part of two decades attempting to outsmart adulthood. I'd been close to marriage and decided it wasn't for me. Owned a home and decided it was not a smart investment. I was averaging two beers a night because that's what the people around me were doing. I wasn't really depressed, but I also wasn't using any force besides inertia to determine my daily routine, let alone larger goals. Life was starting to catch up, and I was trying to fend it off. Pluma, a friend of a friend, was offering a gentle and loving container for ecological and cosmological orientation and awareness. I'll be the first to admit that it sounded pretty fruity. My plan, like that of most magazine writers covering ayahuasca, was to rubberneck at the barfing and smirk at the cultish spectacle, until it turned out that the drugs actually worked. I never had a drug phase beyond experimenting with pot briefly in high school. It wasn't until I was 36 and had ended a long relationship that I met Emma, who spent much of the past decade going to festivals like Burning Man. Emma is into glitter and horses, and when given the choice between wearing clothes and not wearing clothes, will generally choose the latter. She's also working on a master's degree in environmental management at Harvard. On a clear weekend last summer, we went to the mountains to scout elk for a fall archery hunt. Emma brought a thermos of magic mushrooms ground into peppermint tea, and after dinner, I got over my Nancy Reagan anxiety, and we drank, about 1.7 grams each. I'd always been led to believe that shrooms were things college kids did to see pretty colors and that eating them was basically like poisoning yourself. More than a few friends have since told me that they had tried them in college but had bad experiences. At first, nothing happened. My expectations were low. "These don't work on me," I said. Maybe 40 minutes later, there was a shift. My five senses melted together, and I started absorbing the world directly instead of perceiving individual sensations. This gave way to rotating mandalas in the most high-def imagery I'd ever seen. Fractal cuboid design superimposed over everything. A suspicion that the artists of Eastern religion weren't imagining patterns but copying them. The Gaia hypothesis, the burning bush, whatever it was that Picasso saw in people's faces, and a feeling that I'd been let in on an old joke that had been told for years by people who were smarter than me. Time stopped and started, spaces grew and shrank, but most important, the universe emerged in pulsating outlines between the stars of the Milky Way. Along with it came a feeling of interconnectedness and the sense that many of the things I'd spent time worrying about were frivolous compared with health, friendship, and purpose. having taken ayahuasca on 3 occasions now and psilocybin a few more, it's hard to say exactly what the effects of psychedelics have been on me. Many people will call them an excuse to get high, cloaked in the guise of cosmic enlightenment. Maybe, and perhaps this is a good time to confess that I've grown a man bun, but over the past year I've gradually lost interest in alcohol. One of the latent effects of ayahuasca has been a heightened sense of the present moment. Alcohol tends to numb that. Last October, I joined a CrossFit gym. Yeah, another cliche midlife move. I'd never belonged to a gym before and had certainly never been disciplined enough to make organized fitness part of my routine. But after a year, I'm still going 3 days a week. My abs have reemerged after a decade-long hiatus. I've also become less snarky, though I still have flare-ups. Small slights and petty aggressions seem fleeting now compared with existential questions and actual gratitude for how much has gone right. My town of Santa Fe turns out to be a hub of American plant medicine. Emma and I signed up for a 2-night ceremony with one of the city's many shamanic practitioners. As before, the demographic ranged from a slightly hippie-ish to housewives to therapists. Also, as before, our leader was a Caucasian who'd spent a significant amount of time in the jungle learning his trade. 30 people were arrayed around the room on camping mats, each with the now obligatory painter's bucket. The leader said prayers, whistled and sang to the medicine, then poured it into small paper cups. We drank the strong liquid and turned out the lights, and the singing began. I spent the next hour in a semi-lucid stupor, racing around sky-based freeways of futuristic city in hovering spaceships. The ships gave me motion sickness, and I threw up in my bucket. Alternately, I was shown scenes of humans with jaguar faces. I've had no experiences with jaguars or spaceships, which makes me wonder whether pre-Columbian tribesmen might have seen figments of cultures that weren't theirs, either. The more you try to think about it, the more you realize there's nothing in your logic toolkit that can explain what you're seeing. When I came to, Emma was annoyed. The medicine hadn't worked for her at all. But on night 2, it finally clicked. Half an hour after drinking, she sat up, purged, and then lay back. "This is awesome," she said, her eyes closed. I waited and waited, drank a second cup, and went up for a healing with a woman who told me I'd been an apprentice to a powerful shaman in a previous life. Bonus. But had my powers curtailed because I hadn't used them responsibly. Damn it. Convinced that I needed to purge, I went back to my mat and willed the room to spin. Nothing. And then, when I gave up, this incredible weight lifted from me, and my breathing became clear, focused, and circular. It was like reaching a warp level in meditation. Then the vibe in the room went from solemn ceremony to something like an acoustic rave. A woman in her early 20s who'd been road tripping across Colorado took a guitar down from the wall and launched fiercely into a familiar-sounding song. "Is this the theme song to Pocahontas?" finished Emma. 29 tripping adults sat glued to their camping mats, barf buckets at the ready, right through the very last courses of "Paint with All the Colors of the Wind." Somewhere near the end, I noticed that the room, just as Pluma Blanco had promised my first time, seemed like a gentle and loving container. Will I keep going back to ayahuasca? It's hard to say. One thing other people tell me is that the experience produces more questions than answers. It's not a truth serum so much as a way to shake up the snow globe. To friends, I've described the effects of DMT as like having my brain deposited into Roger Federer's body to play a few sets of tennis. When the experience was over, I still couldn't play like him. But I did have an understanding of the level of mindful focus that's possible. and having seen that changes the way you play the game. Or it could just be frying my brain. Drugs are bad, right? This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Outside Magazine. On the Health and Science page, life does flash before a dying person's eyes. People who are about to die really do see their life flash before their eyes, but not in the way it happens in the movies. That's the conclusion of a new Israeli study into the phenomenon, which has labeled the pre-death flashbacks life review experiences, or LREs, said the Daily Telegraph. Researchers from Jerusalem's Hadassah University spoke to 271 people who had undergone a near-death experience with an LRE. Whereas flashbacks in the movies typically involve a sequential highlight reel of meaningful moments, study participants said their memories came at them in no particular order, often simultaneously. Some recalled reliving their own experiences from someone else's perspective, and even said they could feel that other person's pain. Many of the participants said they lost all sense of time during the LRE. A moment and 1,000 years, both and neither, said one. It all happened at once. People who had LREs said it made a profound and lasting impact on their view of life. The researchers speculate that the phenomenon may be linked to the brain regions responsible for storing autobiographical memories. These parts of the brain are the last to shut down following oxygen and blood loss, researchers say, and may be triggered to replay their store of life events in extreme conditions of psychological and physiological stress. Making metallic hydrogen. Researchers at Harvard may have created what could become the most valuable material on the planet. Solid metallic hydrogen. Physicists have been trying to produce a hard form of the most abundant element in the universe for more than 80 years. Achieving this state involves squeezing atoms with such extraordinary pressure that they stack up in a lattice and their electrons are stripped off and moved around. The researchers say they supercooled liquid hydrogen, then squeezed it between two specially polished and strengthened diamonds, using more pressure than is found at the center of the Earth. This is the holy grail of high-pressure physics, one of the scientists, Isaac Silvera, tells PHYS.org. When you're looking at it, you're looking at something that's never existed before. The findings haven't yet been confirmed. The experiment must now be repeated and a sample tested for stability and conductivity. If metallic hydrogen could be produced in large enough quantities, it could potentially be used to create room temperature superconductors, which could lead to magnetic, levitating high-speed trains, faster computers, and ultra-efficient cars. And we will finish up today on the Talking Points page. First article, Gorsuch. Should Democrats filibuster? To filibuster or not to filibuster, that's the question puzzling Senate Democrats now that President Donald Trump has nominated Neil Gorsuch, a conservative judge on the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court, said Will Ron in CBSNews.com. With Republicans holding a 52-48 seat majority, Democrats can't stop Gorsuch's eventual confirmation. But if they filibuster to block a vote on the nomination, Republicans will very probably turn to the nuclear option, changing the Senate rules to eliminate filibusters of Supreme Court nominees so that the GOP could ram Gorsuch's nomination through with a simple majority rather than 60 votes. Blocking Gorsuch would likely be just a symbolic gesture, said Jason Sattler in USA Today. But Republicans stole the Supreme Court seat by refusing to even hold hearings on President Obama's moderate nominee, Merrick Garland, for 10 months. Democrats should make them pay a price for pulling off the heist of the century. This stolen seat claim is a myth, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Back in 2007, Senator Chuck Schumer proclaimed that the Senate should not confirm a Supreme Court nominee during President Bush's final year. Besides, Democrats themselves threatened to nuke the Supreme Court filibuster just last year, when they expected to win both the presidency and the Senate. Given that Gorsuch is a respected mainstream conservative filling a conservative justice's seat, said Jim Newell in Slate.com, it would be strategically foolish for Democrats to waste the filibuster now. They should save it in case one of the liberal seats opens during this presidency, as is likely. Trump could then tip the court 6-3 in conservatives' favor for decades. At that point, a Democratic filibuster would be more widely perceived as reasonable, an extraordinary response to an extraordinary action. The Democrats can't win no matter what they do, said John Cassidy in The New Yorker, but they can still score some points and energize their liberal base ahead of the 2018 midterms if they use Gorsuch's hearings to ask embarrassing questions. To highlight Trump's authoritarianism, senators should ask the nominee what he thinks courts should do if a president defies their orders, and whether he thinks the Emoluments Clause prohibits a president from accepting foreign payments. Losing battles are sometimes worth waging, especially if they encourage your side and cause lasting damage to the enemy. Melania Trump, an absent first lady. Where's Melania? Said Krissa Thompson in the Washington Post. For the first few weeks of President Trump's presidency, our reluctant new first lady has been barely visible. Her chief of staff sits alone in the East Wing while other key positions remain unfilled. Melania Trump has yet to officially announce any signature issue, a tradition for first ladies, and the Slovenian-born former model has decided to remain living in New York City's Trump Tower until her 10-year-old son, Barron, finishes the school year. Then there is the viral Inauguration Day video capturing the first lady dutifully smiling at her husband, and when he turns his back, letting her face droop into a tragic mask of gloom and dread. The images spawned the trending topic, hashtag Free Melania, as well as signs at the Women's March reading, Melania, blink twice if you need help. Give Melania a break, said Andrew Pacer in the New York Post. She's just slowly feeling her way around her new role and has made it perfectly clear her first job as First Lady is to protect Barron, who has already been subjected to vicious public ridicule by Trump haters. If Melania thinks it's in his best interest to stay in Manhattan with her, she deserves credit for breaking with custom. Still, there's something selfish about Melania's decision to abdicate the First Lady's traditional duties, said L.V. Anderson in Slate.com. By failing to appoint anyone to run the White House visitor's office, Melania has caused the White House to suspend all public tours. Can you imagine the outcry by Republicans had Michelle Obama done the same? It would have been a front-page scandal. Let's not forget that politics is a foreign art to Melania, said Matt Latimer in Politico.com. If she does build the confidence to embrace her role, Melania could turn out to be one of the president's most powerful political assets. A graceful and elegant figure, she could convince many skeptical Americans that her husband is not a solitary, impulsive, dangerous monster. Whatever she chooses to do, said Jill Filipovich in Cosmopolitan.com, we should treat her with some empathy, given what we know about her husband. But Melania is a grown woman, not just an injured little bird, and should be held just as accountable as anyone else in close personal proximity to power. And a short note or two. Gaining refugee status in the U.S. takes an average of 18 to 24 months, most of it conducted abroad. It involves screening by the United Nations and 8 different federal government agencies, as well as 3 face-to-face interviews, biometric security checks, background checks, and security database checks. About half of U.S. startups that are estimated to be worth more than $1 billion were founded by immigrants, according to the National Foundation for American Policy, a think tank. Apple co-founder Steve Jobs was the son of a Syrian immigrant. And Google co-founder Sergey Brin is a refugee from the former Soviet Union. Gun sales have slowed in the wake of President Trump's victory, apparently because of reduced fears that guns will be banned. Background checks on gun purchases fell 20% in January from a year ago, according to FBI data. U.S. imports made up just 15% of our gross domestic product in 2015, which makes us less reliant on imports than almost any other country. Less than 3% of U.S. spending is on Chinese imports. And we'll finish with a quote from psychologist Abraham Maslow. A first-rate soup is more creative than a second-rate painting. Well, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.